It's the weekend before the major election, and welcome this morning to the Beacon. I will be so glad when Tuesday hits.
I have to tell you, I have been experiencing the worst anxiety at night, and I honestly think it has something to do with this just politically nasty, divisive climate that we are currently living in.
That we currently are living in, that's right.
Every single day we're just inundated and saturated with all of this negativity, and it's really hard to keep positive and to feel good.
I've never been a Donald Trump fan.
No.
Not from day one.
No.
And he's only proved what an ass he is.
He's just...
And he's just... If you know, I'm not going to be drastic and say I'm moving to another country.
Right.
But if he gets the button, we all better be watching out for
ourselves. Have to be careful. I really do. And you know what? It's so unfortunate because he... You know, he's such a narcissistic... Yeah. I would even go so far to say he's such a supremacist. I mean, he's a Donald Trump fan. He just thinks that he is above...
He's a dictator.
He's a dictator. Absolutely. And he has given a platform for all of the racists in our country, the xenophobes,
the
misogynists. They have all come out.
You know, now I want you to know, this is not the opinion of the Lighthouse. This is us. That we, Lainey Kleeman and me, Bill Jurek, are voicing our view, and we have to, because we have to let you know to use common sense, especially if you have a disability, because that man hates people with disability.
He doesn't give a...
No.
You know
Tinker's
what.
Damn.
No, Tinker's damn. No. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, you know, we're going to find out more about the downside of the ticket.
Yes.
Starting with the senator. I voted early, by the way.
I'm going to today, actually.
And Paul's going to talk to us. Paul Issiger from WGN-TV, going to talk to us about the downside of the ticket.
Good. This is perfect timing. I'm glad he's here.
Yep. I called him this week. He earlier this week, and he said, yeah, I'd be more than glad to.
Awesome.
So that's terrific. It's going to be crazy around GN.
Oh, yeah. It's nice that he's taking a few minutes out for us.
Yep.
Very appreciative of that.
I really am.
Okay, good.
And then
we've got our buddy Brett, our intern, who is reviewing the opera.
That's right.
That's so cool.
Oh, do you know, I used to go take voice lessons.
At the
Fine Arts Building on Michigan Avenue.
Okay.
Have you ever been in there?
I don't think I have, actually.
Years ago, they used to have the elevator with the elevator operator, and it was a cage.
Wow.
And you'd get out, and this thing would bounce. It would get to the floor and then bounce.
Oh, it's so old school.
But you'd hear all these people down the hall.
How neat.
But that's how they taught me a voice lesson for radio and television.
Yeah, I mean, it's all the same parts.
Yep.
You got to get them working the same way.
The instructor I had was a man named Everett Clark. And he was the, I think I told this story before, he was the whistler on the radio back, the East Coast whistler.
I think so,
on the radio. And he did a lot of other things, too. Very dramatic readings and things. And I met him the first time, and I knocked on his door to let him know I was there. And he came to the door, this very imposing gentleman. And he said, my voice is not good today. But he said, may I help you?
Oh, boy.
And I said, hello, Mr. Clark. I says, I'm Bill Jurek. I have a 1 o'clock appointment with you. He says, won't you come in, please?
Wow.
And he says to me, he says, what would you like to do? I says, well, I want to be a professional, successful radio and television announcer. He says, all right. He said, we'll do a few exercises today, and we'll determine whether or not you should get into radio and television or drive a truck. So, I mean, he was blatantly honest.
Wow.
But with him, I ended up being good, I guess, because I did Shakespeare.
Yeah.
On the stage of the Lyric Opera.
Well,
so it was good.
You did Shakespeare on the stage?
I did Shakespeare.
What?
Yes, ma'am.
Boy, that is a side of you I've never heard
and
of.
And you have no idea how big that stage is.
Oh, I can't imagine.
Oh, my. You got to take a bus.
Wow.
To get to the back wall.
That's okay. Oh, for heaven's sake. Honestly. You'll have to tell me that story sometime.
I will. I'll
very
tell you.
Cool.
It was a lot of fun.
It sounds like
a lot of fun, you know. They didn't ask me back, but at least once was a good one.
You know what? Sometimes it's more than most people get.
You know what? That's it. My 5 minutes worth of fame.
That's right.
And what else have we got then?
We've got me.
Oh, yes,
thanks
we
for remembering
have you.
Me. Thank you very much.
With your Thanksgiving tips.
We got a few more tips on how to have a healthful and happy Thanksgiving.
And then Tom's Corner.
Yep.
So we'll get things underway here with Paul Lissigore, political analyst with WGN-TV. I'm Bill Jurek.
I'm Lainey Kleeman.
We'll be right back.
1.4 million people in Illinois really want to work but can't. If they get jobs, they could lose their Medicaid health coverage, and private insurance is difficult to obtain. This is the reality for people with disabilities. The Health Benefits for Workers with Disabilities program can help. HBWD is a state program that provides health insurance for working individuals with disabilities. Call 800-226-0768 or visit hbwdillinois.com. Don't let your disability keep you from working.
This is the story of Daniel, who was born 2 months early. His lungs weren't ready. His heart wasn't ready. His parents could only hope that one day he would leave the hospital healthy, and they would all live happily ever after. Daniel's is just one of the more than 500,000 stories of babies born prematurely last year. You can help the March of Dimes stop premature birth and bring more babies home healthy. Learn how at marchofdimes.com. Working together for stronger, healthier babies.
You know, Tuesday will finally be here. And I think there's a lot of people in this country who breathe a sigh of relief that the campaigning and everything is over. But that may only be the beginning. Paul Lissick from Channel 9 is joining us. He is the host of a very interesting political show every night on CLTV and does fantastic contributions to the Channel 9 news as well. Paul, welcome to the show. It's nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Bill. Yeah, our show's called Politics Tonight every night at 5:30.
Politics Tonight. Okay, that's it. Thank you. I knew it was politics something, but I wanted to get it right. We've got the big election coming up. I was going to talk about down ballot is when we and I set up this interview last week, talk about the senatorial races and the representative races and that, but we had some interesting news happen over last weekend that kind of threw everything into a tizzy. What's your perception of what this WikiLeaks thing and these
and then more the James Comey memo,
yes,
the FBI memo,
yes, right,
which threw things. So here's the thing, and I should say for your listeners who are not familiar with my work, I'm the political analyst for WGN, which means I am neutral. So
right.
While people often hear what I say and then you know kind of add a partisan flavor to it in their own head, my goal is to try and be as neutral as I can and just be sort of balanced in how I say it. So
sure.
In responding to your question, you know, the issuance of the letter to both the Republican, people say he only sent it to the Republican committee chairs. That's not true. He CC'd the Democratic representative leadership.
Okay.
So both sides got the memo from James Comey, which said, I'm just letting you know under my obligation to keep you informed that there are more emails that have been found. And, you know, the problem is that because that letter was so sketchy, so to speak, so we don't know. He hadn't seen anything. There hadn't even been a warrant to review those emails. It raises questions as to why he would do it.
Right.
Now, his answer for why he did it would be to say, look, if I didn't say anything until after the election, I'd be accused of rigging the election. If I say it before, I'm going to be accused of doing the same thing, so I lose either way. I'm going to err on the side of transparency. And I get that. The way to have handled that better, I think, would have been to issue that letter that says, we have found an additional source of emails, have not seen them, don't know whether they're relevant, whether they matter, read nothing more into this than a disclosure of emails found. That's what he should have done, which he didn't.
Right.
But what muddied this even further this week was the fact that it also came out that this notion of Russia interfering with with the elections and that kind of impact, while various government outposts were prepared to say this is Russia interfering, they asked the FBI to sign up with that memo, and Comey's response was, no, we're too close to the election. The FBI can't be a part of that. We are not allowed to upset the election. So that really threw me, because he was sensitive enough to realize that he needed to stay out of the election when it came to the Russia issues, but not when it came to finding emails that he hadn't even looked at and left it blank out there about what this even means. So that's the problem. Has it impacted the voting? So far, no. We may see as this as we get, well, we're fairly close to election day anyway, but it appears that there is not a great impact of it. And I think it's probably because the notion of Clinton emails being around are sort of baked in the pie already. No one's shocked when they hear about more emails.
Sure.
You know, the question will be whether anything comes of it in these last moments. But I will tell you, the Department of Justice, and I train the Department of Justice, they have a policy which says they should not get in the way of any elections for a period of 60 days prior to the election. The FBI is an arm of DOJ. They really sort of violated the policy. They didn't break the law, but right. They violated the policy.
But yeah, that's been around for quite a while. And that, as far as the pre-voting, we've a lot of states are into early voting. It's always been absentee voting if you're a serviceman or if you're out of your state and that sort of thing. Do we have any early figures on how many people across the country have early voted?
The early voting, generally speaking, if you just sort of compare it to 2012 numbers, you had about 130 million people vote. About 30 million voted prior to Election Day. Right now, that number looks as though it's well over 20 million. But let's put it this way. Wherever that number ends up, you're still dealing with about 100 million people who will vote on Election Day.
On Election, yeah.
You raise a good point, which is, look, people who voted a week ago, 2 weeks ago, whatever it is, early voting started in their state, you know, all of these late revelations or anything that happens even now in these waning moments doesn't matter because in most states because they have they voted.
Yeah. But there are some states where you're allowed to recall that early vote and go back to the poll on the election day and say, I want to do away with my old vote and recast a new one, right?
Yeah, there's about seven states that allow that. And, you know, the interesting ones to watch, for example, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, those are on the line. I mean, New York is going to go Clinton. But Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, where, you know, those are states that people are keeping an eye on, where votes matter. You know, if somebody is impacted by the Comey memo or something, again, that happens in the last moments of the election,
sure.
Yes, they are allowed to go in and say, you know what, forget that early vote. I want to vote on Election Day and change my vote. So that's a real potential game changer. How many people will take advantage of that? Don't know. But it does add one more sort of kink in the armor that will have to be monitored.
Well, you know, until this was brought up, I didn't even know that existed. But Illinois obviously is not one of those states.
Right.
So, but I didn't even know that existed in other states around the country.
Well, it does, and perhaps it hasn't been a huge issue. But you know, this election is you know, every day you take a look at the results, and, you know, listen, if you go back a week, you know, it was a matter of, hey, Clinton's got it in the bag. The question is it a huge landslide or just a regular landslide?
Right, right, right.
And, you know, and now, given where we are, it's at this point, it's who's going to win this thing? I will tell you that when you look at the electoral maps, the electoral delegate maps, and that's really all that matters, right?
Right.
Ask Al Gore about that. He had more popular votes. He never became president. So
yeah.
It's about the electoral map. It still looks like Clinton has the edge in all of this. Things can happen in this 11:30th hour. But that being said, it looks like she would squeak it out in the electoral map. But nevertheless, clearly the lead that she did have just evaporated in this last week or so.
Now, what do we see as far as, you know, we heard one of the candidates, Trump, keeps talking about it's a rigged election and that sort of thing, and he's not going to accept the results if, you know, if he's not the winner in that. Do we anticipate this not being the peaceful transition that we've always known as a translation of power from one president to a new president?
Well, look, you know, I have to just go with my gut as an American and say, look, no matter what he says, whatever, one way or another, there will be a peaceful transition of power. It's what we've done for 240 years,
sure.
And I believe we'll do it again. I think what he was trying to say, and I this is my speculation, he may have had sort of a Bush v. Gore situation in his mind. He should have never said, I don't know that I'll honor the election results, because that's just un-American. That's just not what you say.
Right.
I think what he was maybe, and I'm going to give him credit on this, and again, I'm trying to be neutral here, so, you know, Democrats will disagree with this, Republicans will say, yeah, that's what he meant. But I think in his, actually, I'm not sure what he had in his head, but the only way it would make any sense would be if you have a Bush versus Gore situation, you know, you had questionable ballot, that kind of thing. I think what he was saying is he would want that to be looked at prior to any final determination if things were that close. The problem is it's not the year 2000 anymore. So the issue of hanging chads and all that doesn't exist anymore. Right. The way that the technology has come into play and people vote, I'm not aware of any place that has the hanging chad situation where we'll face that kind of butterfly ballot situation anymore.
Okay, now moving along, because we've talked quite a bit about the presidential. Quickly, the senatorial race between Tammy Duckworth and Kirk. That seems like it's almost a shoo-in for Duckworth as well. What happened to Kirk?
Well, I'm always hesitant to say it's a done deal because people need to vote and they
right.
need to go out and vote. Certainly Tammy has been strong in the polls. I think there's a few things going on. I think number one, she brings a history, a character history that I think even many Republicans had to respect. Doesn't mean they'll vote for her, but you know, there's nobody who's going to question her patriotism and what she's given to this country. That doesn't necessarily translate into therefore she should be senator.
Right.
But the point is, you have to look at her as an American hero, and I think that's an objective statement. I think where Kirk has gotten himself into trouble, and the question gets raised as to whether he can, you know, experiences some impairment from his stroke that he had a couple of years ago, and I don't know that. Doctors say he's fine, and so we'll accept that. But, you know, some of the comments he's made, like along the lines of patriotism, when Tammy talked about her family going back to the Revolutionary War, and Kirk said, "Oh, I didn't know your dad or your mother made their way over, left Thailand to get over here so that they could vote for George Washington." I mean, and he ended up having to apologize for that, or saying he was going to write in Colin Powell because he could never vote for Hillary Clinton because he can't vote for anybody who supported the Iran deal, except when he was informed that Colin Powell supports the Iran deal. Basically, no further questions, please. So
yeah.
I think he just made some statements and some comments that have given people pause. Look, he's a moderate in the state. I think where you can't write him off is that if there is a sense that Hillary Clinton will win the presidential election, then certainly Republicans are going to want to have a check on her in the Senate, Supreme Court appointments and that sort of thing.
Sure.
And that raises the national question as to whether Democrats will control the Senate. There was a time that it looked 70-80% that the Democrats would take over the Senate. That number is now more in the 50s in terms of likelihood.
That may
be an aspect of people wanting a check and balance.
I see. Okay, I was just going to ask you that, you know, because it seemed like they just automatically figured that if Clinton was going to take the top part of the ticket, that it would trickle down to the senatorial part, and the Senate looked like it was going to go back into being a blue Senate again.
Well, and it did look that way, and it still looks that way more likely than not, but not as certain. But here's the question about that, which is ordinarily, you know, to put, when you have Barack Obama on the ticket, and again, for people
right.
that don't like Obama, so be it. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm saying is you had people who were Obama supporters who got out there and said, "And let's change that Senate, man. We got to give Obama the support he needs in the Senate." You could say, the same about Romney or McCain. When
sure.
you support that candidate, you want to vote down ticket the same way. That's not the election we have this year. For the first time in history, there are some people, of course, who support the candidates, obviously, but that you have the largest, look, these are the two most disliked nominees in the history of polling, period.
Sure. Yeah.
So you've got a situation where you have the vast majority of people going in just saying, you know, basically just, I'm going to hold my nose. I can't vote for that person, so I'm going to deal with it and vote for this person. Well, if that's your thought process, the notion of, and let me vote down ballot, really doesn't apply to the
mm-hmm.
extent it typically does. And that's why I make the point of saying if people who can't handle Trump are going to vote for Clinton, you might just see them voting Republican in the Senate down ballot or congressional races. And the same would be true if people hate Clinton so much that they're going to just vote for Donald Trump because they just can't see her. You might see them saying, but you know what? I'm going to give Duckworth my vote because I want to see the balance.
Sure.
That's why this is a little more unpredictable. We'll know more after the election because then we'll see where it all comes out. We'll be able to make those kind of conclusions.
Well, you know, it's going to be interesting. There's a couple of other local races, but I know we're all pressed for time. The one, if we could do very quickly, the Dolt Snyder campaign.
Brad Snyder, Bob Dolt?
Yep.
Yeah, 10th District. So you know, the typically the question would be, have voters given have enough reason to fire Bob Dole, right? Because if people don't follow that district very closely, sure. It was Bob Dole, and then after the redistricting, Brad Schneider won, the Democrat. Then he lost to Bob Dole 2 years ago. So these two guys keep going after each other. The polling looks a little stronger for Schneider than it does for Dole.
Okay.
But when you get rid of a candidate or get rid of a congressman, the issue is, does this person deserve to be fired? I'm not sure Bob Dole has given voters enough reason to fire him,
mm-hmm.
although I will say that the polling is suggesting that Schneider may just have an edge. So we're going to see. And then, of course, it's a presidential year. Hillary Clinton, I will say this, she will win Illinois. And so if you have Democrats going out and voting for Hillary, will they then, you know, vote for Brad? We'll see.
Sure. Wait, that's the other thing. Last question. Has to do with Mendoza for running for the comptroller's seat.
Yeah.
There's been, you know, a lot of talk back and forth, and it seems like that, you know, I didn't realize she was holding two offices. That she, from according to what her ads are saying, or what the competitive ads are saying, is that she was holding two offices, and she's, you know, really a player for Madigan. And what are her chances? Because she's young.
So, just for, and your listeners might be interested, I've had both Mendoza and Munger on my show. If people didn't see it, they can watch the interviews at cltv.com/politics tonight. Just go back and look at Mendoza and Munger. And a segment that I have on my show when I have those candidates is called Setting the Record Straight. And what I do is I let both candidates, I give them the allegations being rendered against them in ads, and I let them respond. So Mendoza, I said that very thing to her, Bill. Basically, you know what? You're accused of being Madigan's lapdog, and you know, you're a big Madigan supporter, and people don't want him to have any more power, because one thing an SIU poll showed a couple of weeks ago is that Madigan isn't favored anywhere in the state.
Right.
Chicago, not even downstate, anywhere. And her answer to that was, look, when I first entered public office, I ran against the Madigan pick, and he beat me. And then I posed him again, and then I beat him. She said, Madigan didn't talk to me for 4 years. I'm no Madigan lapdog. So that was her response to that. With regard to holding the two jobs, she did hold two jobs, but she said she has always issued statements, and it's all for the record, where she said, look, anytime I am on city business, I am not to be paid by the state. So she was very careful about making sure she only got one or the other. I asked her about her pensions and collecting two pensions, and she talked about the way that works, which is a blended rate, and that she is not taking advantage of it. So she seemed to be well-informed and very articulate about avoiding the ethical lapses that she was being accused of. Now, if people want to listen to what I just said and said, oh, the heck with it, she's a total Madigan person, fine, you believe what you want. I'm just
sure.
telling you what she said. On the fairness end, Munger, who I said, look, you're a Rauner appointee. People think you're Rauner's lapdog. And she responded by saying, look, I've gone against Bruce Rauner. He wanted me to hold the dues back that are to be paid to unions and didn't want me to pay him. And I said, I'm not doing it. And I paid him. She said, I'm making sure that I think that the legislators should be put at the back of the line when it comes to getting paid, including myself. So both of them were very articulate in responding to the allegations of the other side. The only advice I have for people is, you know, when you watch these ads, do your homework. Don't just accept what you see in the ad, because it doesn't mean it's true. And I'll just give you one very, very brief why that is. When somebody says candidate so-and-so supports dismantling Social Security or something like that,
yeah.
Usually it has to do with a vote that they made on something that had nothing to do with that. It was a budget. It was something else. And yet there's a provision put in there about Planned Parenthood or about something. And, of course, that came along with the package. But congressmen will tell you, sometimes you just have to deal with the small piece to get the bigger piece of what you want and what's important for the country. But, of course, they get whacked with that small piece in ads, and there's nothing you can do about it.
And there's nothing you can do about it. You know what? Like you said earlier on, we survived for 240 years. We're going to make it through this, too.
That's it.
Paul, the show that he hosts on CLTV is Politics Tonight. You could see it every night, 6:30, correct?
Weeknights at 5:30, repeats at 10 o'clock, but we also stream online. People can go to WGNTV.com. Unfortunately, it gets complicated, /politics-tonight-live-stream. It's there.
You just got to hunt for it.
Yeah, so folks can check it out.
That's it. Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you, Bill.
Have a great day. That's Paul Listig, who is the political analyst for WGN-TV and also the host of Politics Tonight. I'm Bill Jurek. We'll be back with more after this.
Exercise is hard. So is maintaining a healthy diet. Of course, neither is half as hard as dying. Sadly, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and stroke kill nearly a million people a year. Even sadder, most of these deaths are preventable with a few lifestyle changes, including regular activity, healthier eating, and not smoking. Talk to your doctor about your risk for type 2 diabetes and heart disease. And if your doctor recommends lifestyle changes or medication, listen. The reason so many die is because not enough are willing to change. You can stop it, starting right now. It's your life. Listen to your doctor. Eat better. Get moving. Visit checkupamerica.org or call 1-800-DIABETES. A message from the American Diabetes Association.
Hello there, everybody. This is Brett Shishkoff. I have another What's Around Town review for you. I go around and talk about the accessibility options that I've been able to find at the theaters and museums and whatever else comes my way. And today I have a review. I was able to go out to the Auditorium Theater. I was able to see a show there. Cole Porter, they had a concert kind of for his birthday, and so I was able to enjoy that about a month and a half ago, I would say. I would say as of how accessible it is for people who have, like, wheelchairs, they have an accessible entrance. They do have elevators that can take you up stairs if need be. The upper level is a little bit more difficult to navigate around, I would say. So hopefully, if you do get some tickets, they might be able to work something out with you if you do have, like, a wheelchair, to be able to get your tickets in down the downstairs level, because they have ramps that go on the sides of the seats. The center aisles tend to have steps, so that is a big thing to kind of just recommend. If you are wheelchair accessible, just let them know ahead of time when you are trying to get tickets. They are developing some programs to try and become a little bit more accessible right now. They really, like I said, are just in the developmental stage of it. I was able to take their architectural tour and history of the Auditorium Theater, which was very, very cool experience. Lots of history in this place. It's one of the oldest buildings in Chicago still around. I believe it was 1880s was when it was built. So it's seen a lot. It's had quite a few great concerts there, and Janis Joplin's been there. Smashing Pumpkins has been there most recently. They also are known for having the Joffrey Ballet. So if you're a person who enjoys being able to watch the ballet, this would be the place to do it. It's got a very big, huge stage. So a lot of dancers really love this stage. Some of the things you'll actually get to view there, other than the ballet, like I said, they have music concerts. They'll also do some dancing. Maybe it's a combination of the two. They also rent it out for, you know, just different events that maybe a company would want to rent it out, or weddings. They've had weddings there as well. So it's the tour. I'll just kind of give you a little rundown of what the tour is like. So you kind of start off at the first level. They take you in through the lobby, give you some history of when it was built and how it was built, what they were trying to get across. And it was built to become an opera house. Basically, the opera was coming to New York and going to L.A., but we didn't have anything really here for the opera. And so they decided that this would be the venue for that, until they ended up eventually building the Civic Opera House. So yeah, it started off as one thing, and then it's kind of gone through a few different transitions throughout the years. When it ran out of some funding, when they were in the 1920s, it ended up becoming a place for military to kind of hang out, and they turned it into a bowling alley, among other things, at this point in time. I think it was around World War I, I want to say. So It's one of the favorite places for Rahm Emanuel. He goes there. He loves the ballet. He actually, I guess, used to be into ballet. He used to be a dancer himself. So that was kind of interesting to see or hear about. It does have multiple levels. Like I said, it's a little difficult to, if you are wanting to get into like the seats on the upper level that they have. They still have the old style seats that they originally had when it was first built up there. So if you can do stairs, you should be fine with the tour and any show. If you have difficulty with stairs, then like I said, the recommendation is to kind of see if you can find some seats down in the first level. Would be the easiest way for you to go. Some of the things that actually I'm pretty excited to talk about, they will be having a few things coming up there in November, both of which I'm going to be attending. November 11th, they have Orbert Davis, who is going to be there with the Chicago Jazz Philharmonic, which is really, really cool. When I went to see Cole Porter and having a big band in front of me and great singers, it made me realize that I miss a whole broad range of great music that's out there. And so now being able to go to this jazz concert, they're going to be covering jazz, blues, some ragtime music, doing a dedication to veterans. It falls on November 11th, which is Veterans Day. So, yeah, it's a very, very fun, cool place to be able to go see a concert. It has great acoustics. It actually, like I said, was made for the opera. And in the opera, you normally don't use any speakers. And so you have to have very good acoustics for it to work. So if you want to find one of the better places to see a concert with great acoustics, there really isn't too much else out there that are better than this place. So I would definitely recommend come and check it out with me. Like I said, it's November 11th. If you'd like to get some more information on how to get tickets, it's at the website is www.auditoriumtheater.org. Once again, this is Brett Shishkoff, and this was a field report review of the Auditorium Theater. I hope to see you guys out and about, and I will see you next time.
Okay, so just type the job website address here. That's it. Then you enter what job you're looking for there.
Electrician.
This is Peter. Recently, he got help going on the internet for the first time to look for a new job.
Okay. Then you just hit search and...
In the past, Peter's gotten work through people he knew, but he heard there were more jobs online.
There we go.
These are all for me?
Uh-huh.
Really?
He had no idea just how many.
I can't believe it. This one looks good.
Peter is thinking the internet might be for him after all.
And this is just one website.
Wow. Why didn't I do this sooner?
See what the internet can help you do at everyoneon.org or call 1-855-387-9166 to find a free training class near you. Brought to you by Connect to Compete and the Ad Council.
You know, I forgot to mention in the first segment, this is our second to last show.
Oh, right.
On WCPT.
Yes. We're trying to block it out, I think.
I think so.
Yeah.
It's only going to be on the internet from there on.
Yes.
And we're sorry.
Yeah, it's not our choice.
It's not our choice.
We're
believe
not happy
me.
About it.
We're sorry that it has to happen, but the powers that be have made the decision. And, well, you know.
Those that pay the bills.
Though they pay the bills.
Yeah. So yeah. We don't have a whole lot of choice in the matter.
We don't.
But
what are you going to do?
We're still around.
And
we're just going to be internet-based only now.
Yep, we'll be on Chris Radio on Wednesday nights from 7 to 8, and then on ACB Radio, American Council of the Blind Radio on Tuesdays.
What time on Tuesdays?
So that, it's all day. It runs on and off.
Okay.
Different hours.
Okay, and then you can find us online on the Chicago Beacon website as well, or the Chicago Lighthouse website as well, for our podcast.
Right,
so
exactly.
That's, you can access us there anytime.
All right, so now
yes,
it's your turn in the spotlight with the rest of the Gobble Gobble Dinner ideas.
Yes, it is. Thank you so much as I pull up my Let me vamp for a minute while I pull up my recipes. Okay, oh, I'm good. I'm here. All I got
right.
it.
All right.
Well, you're not going to like this one because we talked about this last week, but what's we're going to talk about making homemade cranberry sauce.
Okay,
oh,
go
please.
Ahead.
I know some people are diehards about that can of gel.
Oh, God, I like it when it shows the rings.
Yeah, that's the thing. It has the rings on it. So
it's wonderful.
It's not wonderful.
And if it's perfect on a Kaiser roll for leftovers.
It's not. Yes, you can do so much better if you just make it yourself.
No.
All right. Anyway, agree to disagree, my dear.
Yeah.
It has a ton of added sugar. And the gel.
It's okay.
And the gel. Okay. Well, we're talking about healthful Thanksgiving.
Oh,
so
sorry,
in the context of what we're discussing at the moment.
May I say one thing?
Yes.
Excuse me.
Thank you. You are excused.
You
now
have
just
the floor.
Hush and look pretty, would you please?
I will.
Thank you. So here is a recipe for cranberry sauce that isn't quite as sweet because it doesn't call for as much sugar, but it still balances very nicely with the turkey and the mashed potatoes and the stuffing and all the good stuff. In a small pot, combine a 12-ounce bag of cranberries, a half a cup of orange juice, a third cup water, the zest of one orange, and then a third of a cup of granulated sugar. So that's usually called for a cup. Yeah,
right.
So it's a third of a cup.
Yeah.
I prefer to use cane sugar as opposed to like processed refined sugars, but it's the same. I mean, it adds the same thing to
it. Well, it still makes you able to make the
exactly.
You know, so
yeah,
if you use cane, is but you know, it's still a thing that enables you to
sweeten up the sauce. Yeah. So whatever you want.
That's the joke. Go ahead.
I did. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I also, this is a personal preference of mine, but I like to add a little bit of salt to mine because then you get that sweet, salty balance.
Oh, it brings it out. Like
it
does. Some people do that with watermelon, too.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. So I really like this. This recipe specifically does not call for salt, but I always like to add salt to it. And then you're just going to simmer it over medium to low heat until the cranberries start to burst. And I like to keep some of my cranberries intact. So I usually wait until about half of them are burst open and half of them are still intact because that adds a little bit more texture to this cranberry sauce, which I really like. And that'll take about 20 to 25 minutes, and there you go. You have your homemade, less sugar cranberry sauce.
Well, that sounds good.
Yeah, I think it should be.
That's excellent, as a matter of fact.
Thank you very much. High compliments coming from the jelly fan over there.
I know, that's it. And I don't think I'll ever change.
And that's okay.
So they can get that recipe.
Well, I'm not done.
Oh, go ahead.
Just relax.
I'll sit back here.
Thank you.
I'll be over here in a corner.
I'll let you know when I'm ready for you.
Yeah.
Thank you. The next recipe we're going to talk about is Brussels sprouts. I know some people don't like them. I'm a big, huge fan. Oh, love them. Love them so much. So this is a way that you can make them without, like you can get them soft and caramelized without using a whole lot of oil. Traditionally, they're made as you just keep them in their little heads of Brussels sprouts, and then you sprinkle oil on them, salt and pepper, and then you roast them. But sometimes that takes a lot of oil to get the consistency of the Brussels sprout nice and roasted.
I'll give you my recipe when you're done.
Perfect. So this way, if you thinly slice your Brussels sprouts, and it looks like you can actually put them in a food processor and just sort of grind them up until they, just give them a little spin there. And then you kind of pile them up on your cookie sheet. And all you have to do is sprinkle a little bit of oil in that on there because the Brussels sprout, like at the bottom in the middle, will actually start to steam. So the inside gets real steamy, and then the outside pile gets nice and crisp. So you can do it that way as well, and you can combine it with olive oil and then, you know, garlic cloves or salt and pepper, I mean, whatever you want to kind of taste it up yourself. And now, finally for today, we can make pumpkin pie filling with almond milk instead of evaporated milk. Because evaporated milk is very, very high in sugar and fat and all kinds of nasty stuff. And so it's like 3/4 of the sugar that you're using and then twice as much cinnamon.
You know, the Carnation people are not going to appreciate your comments.
I know, but I know. So, I mean, essentially what you can do is you can just follow the recipe on the back of your pumpkin can, but substitute the unsweetened almond milk, excuse me, other way around, substitute for evaporated milk, the unsweetened almond milk, and then cut down the sugar by 3/4. So if it calls for, I don't even know offhand, but if it calls for a cup of sugar, then do a quarter cup of sugar.
Sure, that makes sense.
And then just add a whole bunch of extra spice to it.
And voila.
Voila. I mean, follow the recipe because I know it needs to be baked and whatnot, but when putting the filling together, use those tips and you'll have a much healthier, much lighter, but just as delicious pumpkin pie.
Pumpkin pie. Yeah. Good. Now, my recipe for Brussels sprouts, and actually it works for cauliflower too.
Ooh.
What I do is I boil up the cauliflower and I'll use cauliflower.
Okay.
Boil it up in a pot, till it gets nice and soft, and you get primarily the rosettes that you're going to have, and you can save the stems if you'd like. You know, some people like the stems.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, just like
whatever you want.
You drain the pot of water by dumping the cauliflower into a colander, and then you know let the let it drain a little bit and kind of move it around and that sort of thing. Then you're not going to like this.
Uh-oh. What do you add to it?
Then you put the cauliflower back in the
pot,
and you take a quarter stick of butter. Kellogg cornflakes.
What?
Kellogg cornflakes you put in there.
Wow.
And you stir it around, and it is delightful.
Wow.
My grandmother, who lived to be 94 years old, bought the recipe from Poland.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was absolutely, and you can do that to Brussels sprouts. You can do it to green beans.
Just butter and cornflakes?
Just butter and cornflakes.
Wow. I would never would have thought.
Cornflakes, yeah.
Wow. All
you know,
right.
It's a little, obviously, salt.
Yeah.
You know, when you're boiling
taste the... Taste it up a little bit.
Yeah, when you're boiling the cauliflower the first time.
Okay.
So that's Bill's contribution.
Well, there you go.
And you can get these recipes...
on Facebook. Look for Lighthouse Beacon. They'll be posted there. And also on our Twitter page, Lighthouse Beacon. They'll be posted there.
Okay. Sounds like a plan.
All right. Awesome.
Stick around. The guys are here. You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do.
Brian Hawkins and Tom Persky.
Hello, everyone. Welcome in Tom's Corner. I'm Brian Hawkins, and Tom is here with a very interesting subject. Is it bioptic driving, or you say it? I can't say it.
Bioptic, right?
Bioptic.
Yeah.
And exactly what is bioptic driving?
Bioptic driving, that's a great topic. It involves people with vision impairment to be able to drive in some states.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, we don't have, as many of you know, we've been talking on this show for years now, macular degeneration being the number one cause of vision loss, but other types of vision loss, it affects the central vision. And so there is no normal pair of glasses that can help you, especially for distance, seeing better in the distance.
Okay.
Because right in the center is where your 20/20 vision cells live, and the macula degenerates, and so many people at the beginning stages can't see 20/20. They can see 20/40 maybe, or 20/50. I talked to a gentleman yesterday. We were had this long discussion. His better eyes 20/50. His other eye might be like 20/70. So he's still able to drive pretty well, especially in the during the daytime. But he knows that he's facing, you know, the ability to not be able to see. He also said he travels a lot. And I said, what do you use to see in the distance? You know, and he said, well, you showed me that telescope that you use, and it's called a monocular telescope.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen you put it up to your eye and look like a spy from the CIA, you know, with a little spy telescope. But that's the only way that you can actually enhance your vision and magnify things across the room or across the street, or if you're driving down the block. And so you can't drive holding a telescope up to your eye.
No, I didn't imagine that.
And you can't drive holding binoculars up to your eye.
Mm-hmm.
Although I did actually see that when I lived in Arizona. We were in a small little town called Green Valley, and this woman was going down the street, and Diane says, look at that. She's got binoculars in front of a little old lady.
Oh, wow. And she's driving with one hand. Yeah.
Driving with one hand and binoculars. So, but imagine if you could drive with binoculars. That's sort of what it's like to use what's called bioptic telescopes. Bio, though, means two, meaning there's two places that you look.
Mm-hmm.
One through your regular part of your glasses. For instance, most people, even with 20/50 or 20/70 vision, can still see the lines in the street and keep the car in the lane, but they couldn't maybe read the signs or you know, things like that. So that's what the miniature telescope is. It's the bioptic telescope is mounted usually in only one eye, the better seeing eye, above where you normally look, and it's actually drilled into the lens, and it sticks out about 1 inch. In Illinois, they have what they call a wide-angle telescope that they require that kind of goes out from the center like a little triangle, and it's a three-power, meaning things are look three times closer when you look through the telescope. So imagine if you're driving, looking through your regular glasses, you're having difficulty seeing farther down the road. You drop your chin and you temporarily look through that telescope, and you can imagine what it would be looking like kind of like looking through binoculars. But you can only, when you're looking through that telescope, you can't drive looking through that part very long, because if something came from the side of your vision, you wouldn't see it. So you have to learn to lift your head, look regularly, you know, then drop your chin, then look up, then drop your chin. So it takes months and months of practice. And so persons who normally couldn't drive, though, in the state of Illinois, if their vision falls below 20/70 in their better seeing eye, can learn and qualify for these special glasses. And that's only done through a low vision optometrist. We're one of the few in the whole state that do it here at the Chicago Lighthouse. So you can make an appointment with the low vision clinic, tell them that you're specifically coming to be evaluated for the bioptic telescopes to see if you qualify. And so the optometrist will actually take the time to evaluate whether you're a candidate. You also have to measure your side vision. So some persons who have glaucoma or retinitis pigmentosa who have reduced side vision, even though they could see well through the telescope, cannot qualify to use that for driving. Now, some people have bought the glasses for other purposes, like going to a play or concert, and they do work well, like in a museum. I actually do have a pair, even though I'm not allowed to drive with them, because back in the day when they were first invented, they experimented on me and they said I could have a pair. And so I do carry them when I go to the museum or go to a baseball game, and they are kind of fun to use. But they do look like you're from another planet a little bit.
There's so nothing wrong with that.
And I still don't wear them in public, I guess you could say.
Okay.
You know, other than at the ball game. Although I've had a lot of people at the baseball park say, hey, what are those? Could I try them? And then I pass them down the row and everybody, hey, these are great. Oh. And I say, can I have them back, please? Because I can't see.
I can't see the game. So but, you can buy the glasses and then practice with them and use them for other things. But then once you get really good at it, then you can go and get qualified for driving.
Yeah, that's right. And the state is pretty specific about what you can do and how you have to do it also. Mm-hmm.
Oh, they are.
And that's the hard part. So, for instance, if you did qualify and the doctor signs the vision form for the state of Illinois, that starts the clock. They don't allow you to drive for 6 months. And you have to practice with them as a passenger so that you get used to the idea of looking up, looking down, and so forth. So if you're in that category and you want to someday maybe use these glasses, you might consider doing that even while you're driving. And then if your spouse or someone else is driving, you could use the glasses for 6 months to fulfill that practice time.
Okay.
And then when you want to get your actual license, it's called a bioptic, you know, driver's license. By the way, bioptic driving, you could Google that and do some of your own research. So it's B-I-O-P-T-I-C, bioptic driving or bioptic telescope glasses. And you'll see every state has different laws about what telescope could be used, how your vision requirements are. For instance, in Illinois, you can use bioptic telescopes between 20/70 and 20/100 in your better seeing eye. Now in Indiana, if your vision fell below 20/100 here in Illinois, Indiana allows you to drive down all the way down to 20/200.
Wow.
And so that's it changes from state to state.
From state to state.
People have actually moved, colleagues of mine have actually moved because they were able to drive during the day with telescopes, and they did not qualify here. And so it's a possibility. We see states like Texas, I believe, has the most bioptic drivers. I think there's over 500 people who are like legally blind driving in Texas. So it kind of sounds kind of scary, but people should really know about it, I think. And so that's part of it. Now, if you go to get your license, there's, I believe, one person in the whole state of Illinois who actually goes in the car with you, and that are kind of an expert in this very, you know, limited area.
Uh-huh.
And so you have to pass with that person in the car. That person's going to be, you know, asking you challenging questions like, what does that sign say as you're going down the road? And if you can't read it, you won't pass, you know. So that's part of the challenge, and that's why it's so important for you to practice and learn how to do this. And if you do pass, another stringent law is you have to go back to that guy every year. So you have to re-qualify, because as we know, macular degeneration can degenerate.
Mm-hmm.
And so as vision changes, so it's not as easy as it sounds. But it's something that I thought was pretty interesting. I had a long conversation with somebody yesterday about it. I said, you know what? I'm going to talk about this on the radio.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's good information. And I believe we had talked about it a long time ago, so it's good to once again cover it and update folks on the procedures. Now, we don't have road shows because you're on hiatus.
We don't.
No,
right.
But if you'll remember, not too long ago, we started a segment last year, Tom Stories, and you've got one today.
My stories are, yeah, amazing. You know, I have friends and colleagues who have lived with vision loss now a long time. This particular friend called me yesterday, and she has Stargardt disease, which is she's had since she was 20 years old, like me. And she's a little younger than me, but now much more mature, have lived with central vision loss. She's also a strikingly good-looking woman, and she's also affluent, and she lives in Atlanta, but not here in Chicago. But she was in an Apple store recently. Now, she's been calling me with questions for all these years, you know, whenever she thinks of something new. And she's called me 5 years ago and was considering getting an iPhone. And I sort of know her well enough to know that this might not be a good idea for her.
Oh, really?
She just was technophobic, mm-hmm. you know. And although she really wanted to try, she went through some computer training and kind of failed miserably. And so I thought, oh, no, not the iPhone. But over the years, you know, she keeps calling me saying, you know, she might do it. And she called me yesterday and said, I got to tell you this story. She said, I went into the Apple store, and some young man, you know, started helping me. And when I told him I was legally blind, he was just so intrigued. You know, he kept looking at my eyes like, wow, you really don't look blind. And, wow, how could this be? You know,
all right.
So then he would sort of test her, like pull something up on the screen and show her the iPhone. And she, no, I can't read that. And the letters, of course, are huge, you know. And he's even more intrigued. Like, he wouldn't let her go.
You know?
He wanted to understand, why does this person look normal, you know, act normal, you know, obviously a great person. And so he stuck with her for a long time. And she said, he convinced me that I could get an iPhone and I could use it. You know, I thought that was really interesting. Interesting story. So that's good for the Apple employees. Everybody needs exposure to these unusual circumstances where people have, you know, hidden, almost like hidden disabilities,
right.
You know, and you never know what you run into, and to try to understand somebody who you've never met before, who can't see well, is an important point. And so I urged her to go ahead and get the phone and to go through some training there in Atlanta. There's an organization for the blind. I also told her about, it's called iFocus, the letter I, F-O-C-U-S, on YouTube. If you search for iFocus, there are videos on how to use an iPhone if you're a blind person or a low vision person.
Oh, okay.
And there's about 25, like, almost like classes that you could, you know, learn, teach yourself. Or if you have somebody teaching you, you could go back on the web each night or every week and do your own little refresher course. And I told her that's what it's going to take. because, you know, you're just going to have to practice every day.
Right.
And it's not going to be easy. And I remember back when I first got my iPhone, I was not doing too well. You know, it took me several months and months of practice. So that's the hard part of trying to describe technology and all these things that are out there to help people. So is that you have to apply yourself, and sometimes you can't explain to the eye doctors, to your family members, how hard it really is sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, everything in its own time. So after 5 years, she finally gets an iPhone. So hope it works for her. All right, well, all we'll right. leave it there. He's Tom Persky. I'm Brian Hawkins. This is The Beacon.
Hi, everyone. This is Alex Trebek, the host of Jeopardy. If your question is, how can someone who is blind enjoy the latest magazine writing and not have to pay a penny? Then the answer is Choice Magazine Listening. Every other month, we'll send you hours of stimulating, unabridged articles, short stories, and poetry from writers such as Russell Baker, Derek Walcott, Joyce Carol Oates, Bill Moyers, and Margaret Atwood. These free special speed cassettes are sent to anyone unable to read because of physical limitations. If you're interested, write today to Listening, Box 10, Port Washington, New York, 11050. We'll also tell you how to get the necessary free Library of Congress talking book player. So write Listening, Box 10, Port Washington, New York, 11050. Or call 516-883-8280. That's 516-883-8280. Thank you.
Are you ready for kids who eat healthy? Good nutrition can lead to great things. To find out how a healthy lifestyle can help your child succeed, go to mypyramid.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the Ad Council and USDA.
I'm Bill Jurek.
I'm Lainey Kleeman.
Andrew Varillo is our associate producer. Brett Shishkoff is our intern. And, of course, Brian Hawkins, not only handling Tom's Corner, but also the duties is making this show sound good. I'm Bill Jurek.
I'm Lainey Kleeman.
Last time next Saturday for The Beacon. Have a great week.